Ian Black is our Middle East editor and is in Doha today for the start of these talks. Ian, what's the mood like?
Well, it's quite sort of bustling. This is Doha, the capital of Qatar, is a town that's well used to international conferences. Qatar is a very small country with big ambition. And the Libya meeting today has certainly got a lot on its plate. It's the second meeting following on from the conference in London at the end of last month, which set the stage, if you like, for how the international community as a whole was going to deal with the extraordinary crisis in Libya. Now, that was a ceremonial launch, and this is getting down to brass tacks with a host of ministers and senior figures from the international community, the West, and from the Arab world as well. Of course, the fact that the meeting is being held in an Arab capital is in itself hugely significant, taken that what we're talking about is a plan to essentially to overthrow the Libyan regime, though it's not put formally quite like that.
I noticed you in the paper today, you were talking about diplomats saying that the aim of the conference was to take stock. That doesn't sound very ambitious.
Well, I mean, it's to take stock, but of a situation which is fraught with difficulties, to try to find a way ahead. I mean, the fact is that, what is it, 6 weeks or so into the Libyan crisis, there is a stalemate, a military stalemate between the Gaddafi regime and the opposition. We've seen the pictures of the toing and froing along the coastal road on the Libyan coast between the Benghazi-based rebels and the regime. We've seen dramatic pictures of the NATO airstrikes against Gaddafi's armed forces and artillery, but we've also seen that the toing and froing has led to an impasse. So you have a military impasse, you have a pretty ambitious international coalition arrayed against Gaddafi, but hemmed in by United Nations resolutions, which are fairly clear about what can and can't be done. It's supposed to protect Libyan civilians. People have called, Barack Obama, David Cameron, Sarkozy have all called for Muammar Gaddafi to step down, but there's no sign of him doing so.
Remind us what's on the table, both the Turkish and the African Union peace plans.
Well, it's not clear that they are on the table in any significant sense. The African Union plan, which is the latest idea, really fell at the first hurdle because the opposition based in Benghazi insisted that it would only talk on the basis of the removal of the current regime, and all the other formulations have talked about transitional periods with Gaddafi and his family, his sons, remaining in power at least for some sort of transitional period. And they say that's completely unacceptable. A ceasefire has met with the same response because the Libyan government has at least twice, if not more, announced the ceasefire and clearly hasn't respected it. There's a complete lack of trust between the two sides. William Hague, the foreign secretary, is here. He's co-chairing the meeting with the Prime Minister of Qatar. Has been talking about tightening UN sanctions. There's talk of setting up some kind of international trust fund to help people in eastern Libya, where the rebels are based. But there's nobody quite got there. Managed to get round the unfortunate fact that the Libyan leader shows no sign of going anywhere. And there's a feeling that this conflict is settling in for quite a long haul, and this meeting here today feels like the first of quite a few that we're going to be seeing over, you know, possibly many months.
William Hague has been doing a round of TV and radio interviews this morning. He complained again about that France and Britain were carrying too much of the burden of the fighting. What are the prospects, do you think, for him persuading other allies to help out more?
Well, this is fairly detailed stuff. This is about the military contribution of some of the NATO allies. I think we're talking about countries like Italy and Belgium, which have made aircraft available, to help enforce the no-fly zone over Libya, but haven't actually been taking part in attacks on the ground, which is obviously the sharp end of the business. And my understanding is that there is the talk behind the scenes of trying to persuade these very sort of contributing countries to do more in the actual combat missions that are being flown. And of course, the whole NATO aspect of this is a subset of increasingly complicated series of international and regional problems about who does what and what the goals are and so on and so forth. There's another very important theme, which is some countries, a few countries, France, Qatar, have recognized the transitional council, the rebel leadership, as the new government of Libya. No other countries have done that. Haig was asked about that and said again that the British government position is that it recognises states, not governments. So there's some frustration there, I think, on the side of the Libyan opposition. But the really intriguing question here today, which is this: yesterday's very dramatic news, which we broke in The Guardian, that Moussa Koussa, the former Libyan foreign minister and the most senior figure yet to defect from the regime, was being allowed to leave Britain, where he'd been, to attend, or at least to come to Doha to talk about the situation. Now, that's met with a very, very frosty response from the Libyan opposition. Chris McGreal, a colleague who's in Benghazi, reported on this today. And here in Doha, you're hearing the same sort of thing from people associated with the Libyan opposition, that Moussa Koussa is a very, very tainted figure due to his long and loyal service with the Gaddafi regime, spending 14 years as the head of its intelligence service, amongst other things. And it's interesting because the British government has set great store by the idea that defections from the regime will weaken Gaddafi and hasten the end game. Well, to judge by at least the initial reception of Moussa Koussa by the opposition, that doesn't look as though it's going to work. It may be that one has to look at this over a longer period, and I suppose that is the strategy.
Is there a danger that he's become a distraction?
Well, I mean, he's a distraction in the sense that he's a very, very important figure, and his defection to Britain in the first place was a significant blow to the regime. But the second part of the equation, that is, that would then have a galvanizing effect or a significant effect on the Libyan opposition, doesn't look as though it's coming true. Now, you talk to British officials, they're fairly cagey on this point, and they hum and haw and say, look, you know, this is a long process, and the Libyan opposition is only just beginning to find its feet, and they reacted suddenly and sharply to Koussa's only statement made about 48 hours ago, before he left Britain, where he warned quite strikingly that if Libya really degenerated into long-term civil war, it stood the risk of becoming another Somalia. Now, that may well be true, but it's also the message that the regime is putting out. So that went down very badly with the Libyan opposition. So it'll be interesting to see in the course of the day whether Koussa indeed makes any kind of public appearance and whether attitudes towards him become any more accommodating, because so far they've been pretty hostile.
Okay, Ian, keep us posted. Thanks a lot.
Matt.